number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to The Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome to The Powerful Conversation with Stuart Knight, myself, and my friend Heather Tay, who I have on the line right now. Hello, Heather. How are you today?
Hello. I'm well, thank you.
You're well? You're feeling good?
I am.
Yeah. Well, welcome to the conversation, and thanks for being, you know, on the show here. I think that, you know, it would be a lot of fun for our listeners to be able to hear you and I have a chat, because you have become, I would say, you know, a recent friend over the last, probably about a year now.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. And I've enjoyed our conversations, even though some of them end up being short ones at parties when we're both kind of in the kitchen at the same time, you know, chugging a bottle of wine. But it's nice to have you on the show. So you're saying you're feeling good. What are you feeling good about these days?
Gosh, I'm feeling good about a new job that I started. So
yeah,
that's been great. I'm feeling good about Powerful Conversation group that you hosted last night and then I went to. That was fantastic as well.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. What about the so this new job, you know, what's the actual title of your position?
So I am the interim executive director of the Imagination Catalyst at OCAD.
Right.
OCAD,
right.
University. Yeah. So it's a contract position. It's a short-term position, but it's been fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you, now I know that you've explained it to me before, but basically you have, I think you said 20 young people who are, you know, have come up with either inventions, essentially, I believe. And then, and you guys have kind of given them the seed money, and you're going to be there to help them bring this to fruition. Is that essentially it?
That's the basic idea. I mean, this doesn't necessarily come with seed money, but we have 20 companies in the accelerator. And yeah, we basically provide them a bunch of resources, whether it be, you know, a place to work, or, you know, simply Wi-Fi, or coaching, one-on-one coaching, mentorship. Nice. Yeah, and then help them get access to money and funds. And actually, we have a venture capital fund as well that they have access to as well. So they can pitch
and
potentially get investment that way. Yeah.
So before we go a little bit further, I'm not sure if you are holding your mic in your hand, but if you are, I would let it dangle, because I think it's maybe a bit too close to your mouth.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, there you go. You sound better.
Better. All right,
wow. Thanks. There we go. So what's been one of the coolest kind of ideas or designs or things that you've seen somebody come up with so far?
Oh, gosh. It's like we've got so many. I mean, one of the cool things that I really, really like is one of our entrepreneurs, Julie Ferrand. She's actually designed a moss graffiti paint.
You told me about this. This is where, like,
yeah.
Can you explain it?
Yeah, it's super cool. So it's actually a paint that you can paint onto a concrete surface. I'm doing air quotes around the word paint.
Right.
You can't see, but yeah, you can paint it onto a concrete surface, and where you paint will actually grow moss.
So how did she come up with an idea like that? You know,
I know that she's a graduate of a university, and she was thinking about ways to improve the air quality in the city.
Okay.
So it's actually pretty neat that she came at it from a design perspective, like trying to solve a design problem, and also realize there could be an artistic aspect too, like a visual design.
Right.
I think.
Right.
So, yeah. So
basically the idea would be is that people can go around the city, they would, you know, do traditional graffiti, but instead of it coming out as paint, or in many cases some ugly stuff that, you know, ends up being what most people call tags, we're now getting, you know, extra oxygen going into the environment, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. And companies can use it for, you know, signs and logos, and individuals can use it in their homes.
Oh, that's
cool. You know, to create moss walls. Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
Fantastic.
So do you ever find yourself, because I go through this, I find myself sometimes feeling, I mean, even though I'm proud of my accomplishments in life, I meet these young people who are coming up with these ideas with my own job, and I'm thinking to myself, God, when I was like in my early 20s, I was just looking to meet girls, you know, and I had like, I just feel like that these younger generation today, do you ever feel intimidated by them?
Oh, sometimes.
I do.
Especially this group, because they're super smart and super driven and super creative too, right? So I don't, for me, I mean, yeah, I had my fair amount of chasing boys, right? Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that I could do this stuff, right?
Right.
I think I had, I felt like there were a lot more rules. Mm-hmm. There were a lot more rules and constraints when I was 20. So my life has been more about, you know, like removing those and breaking those down. And
right.
So many of our entrepreneurs are just like, yeah, why not?
Just do it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think that says a lot about the world that we live in the sense that, you know, you're always ever going to do what you think you're capable of doing. And mm-hmm. I remember having a girlfriend years ago who I was always just taken back by how brazen she was and how confident she was that her business would just do well. Mm-hmm. She would say, oh, I'm just going to call the Toronto Star and mm-hmm. I'm going to tell them that they should do an article on my new store. And I'd be like, oh, well, honey, you know, it doesn't really work that way. You can't just call the Toronto Star. It's not that easy. And you know what? She'd call the Toronto Star, and guess what? They'd be doing an interview with her like within a couple of days. And what I noticed was is that because she'd come from an entrepreneurial background where her father was an extremely successful entrepreneur, a multimillionaire, mm-hmm. for her growing up, she just had this idea of, well, of course, I mean, I've seen it done, and if he can do it, why couldn't I? And plus, she, of course, because her father was a success, she'd gone to private school, and going to private school allowed her to be around other kids who had done great things. And you find yourself thinking, yeah, you know, really it just comes down to just believing you can do something. And for, I'm not sure, like I have a general idea of your upbringing, but for me, mm-hmm. you know, I believe we both come from pretty working class families. And,
yeah,
you know, and the big thing was, if you can just go to university, if you can get a degree and work hard and have a good job, that would be it. But I don't know about you, but I was never told at the dinner table, hey, if you ever just want to go invent something or start a business, you should do that. Like, what was it like for you? Did you get those kinds of messages?
Oh yeah, no, that wasn't the route. But right. Yeah, I know growing up it was, you know, my dad's an engineer. Mm-hmm. Both he and my mom were very focused on us getting our education and going to university. And my mom always thought I should be a doctor.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I ended up studying engineering, but it was more about like getting that professional degree.
Right.
That was the idea. You get the professional degree, you go get a job, and you work that job hard and well, and you keep that job. Right. That was kind of the path.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So what would you say then, you know, if, do you think you'd be doing like what you're doing today had you grown up in an environment where maybe the sky was the limit? Like if Donald Trump was your dad, you know, do you think you'd be doing something different, or do you think you would have gone this route?
I'll probably be doing something different, you know, but yeah. I think we every generation, I mean, some people can take incredible, massive leaps and bounds, right? Mm-hmm. And just sort of come out of the womb going, I am going to create something new.
Right.
You know? And yeah, I mean, with a different family, I'm sure it would probably be a totally different direction for me.
Do you think that on some level, like, you know, knowing this and having these kinds of conversations, do you think that it's our job as a society to really rethink education and the way that we are inspiring young people to maybe think differently, to push themselves differently? Because, you know, it's funny, I saw this really great quote the other day, and I think I may have said this in a recent podcast, but I love it. It said, another day has passed, and once again, I didn't do algebra. And which I thought was a great, you know, fact that, yeah, I get that learning algebra in high school mm-hmm. did help us, you know, perhaps understand math on a certain level, or maybe conditioned our brains a certain way. But when it comes right down to it, we all know that arguably most of what we learn in university or what we learn in high school or college is stuff that we don't end up using later on in our lives. And do you think it needs a change?
Yeah, well, I think it does. I mean, like, the world's changing around us, right? So, yeah, I think it does need a change. But I'm actually grateful for a lot of the things we learned in school.
Oh, yeah?
I am actually. For the process and the rigor and the training and how to set it up. And, you know, maybe I'm just nerdy, but I use algebra a lot, actually, so.
Where do you use algebra? You've got to let me know this. You know, calculating the bill at the restaurant is not using algebra.
No, it's not. It's not. It's not. But I was working out some, you know, financial projections, right? I was trying to do some forecasting.
Okay.
And it was a little bit unclear as to how we would actually construct the forecast, and it was going to come from multiple revenue streams, and we had to sort of work backwards and understand understand some of the margin implications and a lot of that.
Okay.
A lot of that stuff. So
you have your MBA, is that correct?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. So then when you went to school for your MBA, I don't know what it was like for you, because I have a degree in business and economics, and I always felt that a lot of what I was learning in school was kind of almost laughable. I thought to myself, we'd be doing projections on whether or not two multi-billion dollar companies should merge, and we were using mathematical formulas to kind of really break down the answer to that question. And I thought, you know what? I'm pretty sure when I graduate from university at the age of 22 or 23, I don't think I'm going to be the one called upon to find out whether two major multi-billion dollar companies should merge. And hey, where's that new guy? Bring him over here. Tell him to put that formula down.
It didn't happen.
It quickly did not happen for me. So yeah. What was it like for getting your MBA? Did you feel like you were learning practical things you could apply to your life, or was it more just going through the typical business stuff that, just to say you did it?
Yeah, I don't know. It was a lot of frameworks and structures, and it was interesting. I think coming out of my MBA, I ended up using it more in my job afterward, because I became a management consultant, right? So MBA is pretty much designed to create management consultants, among other things, but yeah, it's pretty much designed for that. So
right.
And it worked out, but yeah, I never tried to merge two big multi-billion dollar companies out of the gate.
So what do you want to learn in life that you don't know? Is it a language? Is it a new dance? Is it how to make your own clothes? I mean, what would be something you'd really want to learn?
Gosh, there's a gazillion things probably.
Yeah.
I want to learn how to, do capoeira
you want to start being able to kick people in the face.
Yeah, exactly. It's fairly important. I just watched this video of kangaroos kicking people in the face today and decided I really'd like a tail for my next fight. So I'd recommend looking it up.
Yeah, it's funny you say for your next fight, because that's something that you do on a weekly basis.
Oh, yeah, it's all the time.
For my next fight that I got scheduled for next Thursday, I think I'm going to get myself a tail. Yeah. it's funny when you think about learning things, and I know that for me, it's been a big thing on my mind lately about how I worry that I'm not learning as much. I'm so stuck on working and thinking about what I can do next for the business, and I'm quite often I'll be running an event, whatever it might be, and it's consuming my time, and I'm always saying to myself, I really do need to start taking French lessons, or I really do need to start learning, how to salsa dance. You name it. And a week goes by and a month goes by, and you just really, I guess, have to schedule it. Otherwise it's never going to happen.
Yeah, you do. It won't happen.
Yeah.
The coolest thing that I did just learn, as I went through Second City's improv program.
Oh,
you ever gone through that?
I haven't. No, but tell me what it was like.
Oh, you'd love it. Or you may not like at all think you would need it, but
no, I'm sure I'd love it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. I actually had a colleague at work once tell me that her most amazing training for a sales role was doing improv.
Really?
And I remember the moment she told me that, my stomach completely, it sank. So I was sitting across from her. I was in a sales role myself. She told me those words, and it was the absolute last thing I wanted to do. But I felt like it was the absolute thing that I needed to do next.
So was it a case where she tells you the story and then she says, oh my God, Heather, you should totally do it?
Yeah. And I'm like, crap, that's the last thing I want to do.
Right. The blood's draining from your head. So then what was the process after she said that to you that got you to the point of doing it? Was it one of those like, okay, if I don't call right this very second, it's never going to happen? Or did you take a month to start doing it? What happened?
No, it was kind of funny. It was like, I thought about it. Well, I thought about it because I groaned. Mm-hmm. And then of course, Groupon came up for...
nice. You like a deal.
So the whole Groupon trigger for life and doing something. So yeah, I got a Groupon, sat in it for a year.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And then it was about to expire. And I thought, okay, well, I need to make use of this. So then I registered.
Okay. And so what was your very first class like?
Oh, it was fun, like fun and easy. It's like baby improv, right? It's like it's going in and playing and doing exercises and running around the room and playing tag. And
when you walked in, were you feeling super nervous?
Yes. Like,
and what kind of visions did you have in your mind of things that they were going to get you to do? Was it what happened, or was it completely opposite?
Oh no, in my mind, they were going to get me to go and stand on stage. I don't know, more than naked, something that would make me even more uncomfortable. Like,
right.
You stand on stage, you know, naked in front of a pack of lions. That's what I thought was going to happen, right? Or felt was going to happen. That
right.
was like how nervous I felt. But yeah, we just played games. We played games, and it was like going to the first day of camp.
Okay. And so how long did that last for, this whole program?
I went through it for a year. So they have five levels, and the first two are pretty much play-based. Mm-hmm. And then from the third one going up, there's a lot more, like, I don't know, rigor, but a bit more structure, a bit more things that you're learning, a bit more stretching. It was not as intimidating as I thought it would be. And it was also probably one of the most challenging things I have ever learned in my life.
No kidding. So tell me, how did it change you as a person?
Well, I've always been really good at school, right? So, you know, I was always really great at school, got great grades, went and studied engineering and business, and I knew how to go and learn things that were school. And even things like dance, I guess, right? I've been to lots of dance classes, and it's sort of structured. There's a structured way to learn. You learn moves and you practice it and you get better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, improv it's more about unlearning than it is about learning.
Okay.
It's about taking away all the things that restrict you from talking and all the conversation you had about, oh, I'm not going to sound smart enough, or not going to sound good enough, or oh, that's a stupid idea. Or it's more about taking all that stuff away. Yeah, and it's something that I'm not naturally great at. So it was also really humbling because I'm used to going in. And then even if I'm not naturally great, I'm used to like kind of knowing how to put my head down and just either study harder or work a little bit harder to become better. And there wasn't really any harder thing that I could do. You know, I went to my improv class once a week, and I went home and I, you know, tried to implement it in daily life. And when I was talking to people, there's little techniques that you use about, you know, just saying sort of what comes to mind rather than going through all your filters. So those things I would implement, but still, it was a very, very humbling exercise to be in amongst people who were very naturally gifted and maybe were thinking about going on to an acting career or something like that.
You gave an example there of like how you'd be having a conversation with somebody and instead of letting it go through the filters, you would just say the first thing that comes to mind. How did it affect your confidence in meetings or in one-on-one, let's say, sales calls or going in for an interview? Like, did it affect you anywhere in that capacity of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a specific example, like for a sales call or meeting, but I know in general conversation, it would be, I don't know, there's a lot more freedom. Oh, you know what? A friend of mine told me I was way funnier.
Really?
Yeah, not really intending to be, but just because I don't know, just whatever would come up, you know. But
I told a friend one time who, unfortunately, he got kicked in the face during a soccer game. He had to have jaw surgery, and they had to put this metal kind of like implant in his jaw.
Oh no!
And then finally, after he had healed, I said to him, "I said, you know what?" And I'm like, "I hope this doesn't come across the wrong way, but you're actually better looking now."
Well, you say that, and I think the way funnier comment was meant in pretty much exactly the same way.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, you really weren't funny at all, and now you're just kind of sort of cracking the surface. But.
you're actually, you know, worth hanging around. You're bearable now. Now that you can make jokes. So what do your parents think about what you've done with your life as far as, you know, you got this MBA, you got this good job, you're doing things like Second City, you own property downtown Toronto. What do they ever come out and openly tell you how proud they are of you, or is it something that doesn't happen in your family?
No, it's not. They're not sort of the like straight open type like that, but I know that they are.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I know that they are.
Yeah. How about personally? Yeah. What are you most proud of?
Gosh.
Or one of the first things that comes to mind.
Yeah, well, I'm actually kind of proud of having taken some time off recently.
Oh, really?
Which may sound kind of funny because it's not one of those, you know, people often say maybe they're proud of, I don't know, their marriage or their kids or their job or their university degree. But I'm actually proud that I took some time off.
What do you mean by that?
The short of it is I basically took a bit of a sabbatical. And I had been in the tech world for most of my career and had a good career.
Mm-hmm.
But realized I've had other interests and they weren't really aligned with what I was doing, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. So I needed some time to actually just be still.
Okay.
Yeah, which may sound kind of odd, but...
No, that makes a lot of sense to me. I find that some of my greatest ideas come in moments where I've deliberately carve out space to just be by myself. Sometimes that's jumping on my motorcycle and going for a ride, or sometimes that's just taking a day and walking through the city by myself. And
wait,
I love that.
That's fantastic. And wait, I didn't know you rode motorcycles.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've got a motorcycle. And
what do you ride?
I have a Honda Shadow 750.
Oh, very nice.
Vroom, vroom. We'll have to go for a ride together sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah, you like bikes?
Oh, love bikes. I ride a scooter right now, but I have my Ducati lives in California.
You have a Ducati?
I do.
What?
A Monster 750 dark. It's beautiful.
Oh my God. Yeah. I did not expect to hear that. I love that. So, wow. How long have you been riding for?
Gosh, forever, not forever. 2001, I learned.
Okay.
Yeah, so for 14 years, almost every day.
So your bike's in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Okay.
I gave it to my ex and I have visiting rights.
That and the dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, wow. You know, it scares me though. I don't know about you, but as I get older, I find myself becoming more and more nervous about riding a motorcycle, just because, you know, you get just how absent-minded people are. And especially with now, even in the last, I would say, 4 or 5 years with this addiction to cell phones. And you know, you drive by people and you'll see them texting while they're driving. And if they need to change lanes and you're there, you're dead.
Yeah.
Do you know that right now that they're saying that mobile devices are the number one cause of death for people between the ages of, I believe, 18 and 30.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing to me, like, how much literature there is out there, how many commercials, how many of these viral videos, and you pull up to a set of lights, or you're driving down the street in Toronto or any city around the world, and you look over, and I almost can put my life on it, no pun intended, but I can put my life on it that if I'm going to drive by a woman, especially young women, but the men do it too, who's, let's say, 21 years old, I can almost put my life on it that she's on her phone.
Mm.
And that's scary. I mean, you're literally taking your eyes off the road. That's just, it's like, can you imagine if I were to say to you, listen, when you're driving your car today, just for 5 seconds, close your eyes while you're driving. That would be,
you know what? That'd be crazy.
Right?
But, you know, we should get everybody on two wheels, because if they ever, you know, being a two-wheel rider mm-hmm. makes you so much more focused and attentive to the road.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that would, I think, would be a great experience for people to realize what it actually is like.
Yes.
To have to pay attention and not think of anything else
right.
in order to stay alive.
Oh, yeah. I know.
Right?
I can imagine what it would do for the death rates of motor vehicle accidents. But you know what, though? We're literally, I mean, this is almost becoming a moot conversation in a sense, or a moot point, because we are just, I mean, many are theorizing that we're not even that far. And when I say not far, I mean, we're talking 20, 30 years tops away from people no longer driving cars and them driving themselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that would be fantastic, because people are lousy drivers.
They are. And you know, I like driving.
Not me or you, right?
Of course, we're not.
Yeah.
I like driving, but I think there's something amazing about the idea of what I could get done if I had to go do a speech 3 hours away mm-hmm. and I get in my GPS-controlled car and I just end up, you know, punching the coordinates, and I know that it'll take me 3 hours to get there, and I just sit back and I either read a book or I watch a documentary or I... you know, do some work, whatever it might be. I think that would be fantastic.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what would you, yeah, okay. those are all the things you would do.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. What? But back to your sabbatical. I mean, I think we got on a bit of a tangent there. What did you like? What did this stillness do for you? And where did you go? What did you do?
Gosh, I did a lot of things. I traveled a bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, spent some time back in California, and I went to Indonesia and Fiji. Mm. I spent time renovating a house, so worked on that. And that's so I was busy. Actually, I spent lots of time doing things.
Mm-hmm.
I volunteered. I was working with OCAD and the Imagination Catalyst here,
mm-hmm.
as a mentor and on the advisory board. I did some consulting work a little bit here and there, but. I also did a few personal development courses too.
Okay.
Right.
And yeah. Did this stillness bring you to a deeper understanding of what it was that you did want?
It did.
And what was that?
Well, I realized that I have always loved design.
Mm.
I've always really loved design. But really, you know, when you get it, break it down, I've always really loved beauty.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And beauty, I mean, that can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but in particular, I'm really interested in beauty in the space around us.
Okay.
So homes, public spaces, where we work, where we live, where we play, and particularly in cities.
Right.
So yeah, like urban spaces, parkland. I think it's beauty is hugely inspiring,
mm-hmm.
and hugely, I don't know, motivating is not the right word, but it almost gives people the space with which to create.
Right.
And which to, you know, live their lives in the best possible way.
So what do you think that cities are doing? Like, what are we missing in most of our cities? Are we just not taking advantage of these spaces? Because I don't know about you, but I find myself and I see cities that do it really well, but sometimes I get frustrated with Toronto when I go down the street and I'll see, you know, for example, on this summer, I think about John Street did this where they, you know, our city gets really creative and they take up an entire lane and all they basically do is put benches down.
Mm.
And you think to yourself, of all the things you could have done with all and the amount of money you spent on that, there's nothing really. First of all, I would say on any given day, maybe 10% of the benches were even occupied.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no forethought given to whether or not people would use these. And the other thing is that all I did was just put benches down. It wasn't like there was anything creative about the benches. There was nothing interactive about the benches. There was nothing that was inspiring. It was just benches down.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think that what do most cities miss when it comes to really creating beautiful spaces?
Well, you know what? I'll actually flip it on the other side because I think that now is the time when – you know, not every city gets right all the time, but I think now is the time when cities are really paying attention to design and really paying attention to the people that live in it. And there's some amazing creative projects that are coming out of cities, right?
Okay.
So, yeah. So, for example, in Toronto, I think one of the spaces that is phenomenal is Evergreen Brickworks.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, and there they've taken an old brick factory and created a beautiful space for everybody to walk around in,
mm-hmm.
and kind of a destination point for the community. And there's farmer markets and great events are held there. You know, it was an old quarry and an old big brick factory.
Right.
And now it's gorgeous paths and great event space.
Right.
So they're doing something that's really, really right.
Okay.
And Artscape is another one. I mean, their spaces are sort of a mix of sort of public-private, I guess, artists use spaces. But if you take a space like Witchwood Barns,
mm-hmm.
And they've done a fantastic job there.
Okay.
And again, I've gone to a number of events and, you know, see just kids playing out in the front lawn. You know, they focus a lot on not just creating – I mean, they create homes for artists, mm-hmm. at sort of below market rates. But they also focus a lot on what impact their space has in the community around.
Right.
So some of the, yeah, I know what the project you were talking about on John Street isn't my favorite, but
mm-hmm. I see your point though. I think that there's no doubt about it. For every area where we could have done better, there's many examples of areas where we've done it right and we've done well, and not just in Toronto but other cities. And it's true, you do see this now. I find that usually it's the big cities, the New Yorks, the Londons, and that usually start the ball rolling where other smaller cities look at them and they take their cues and go, oh, wow, you know, New York City converted an entire train track, the High Line, which I'm sure you know about.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Into a public art space, which is such a one of the highlights of New York. If anyone ever goes there, it's something that everyone should do. Just walk down the High Line and you'll see a train track that was converted into essentially an outdoor art gallery.
Yeah.
You know,
and it's phenomenal. And we have the potential to do that here as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the Lower Don revitalization, they're talking about it being called the Ribbon Project.
Okay.
And actually, you know, improving the access and wayfinding and also putting public art down the trail that goes down the Don.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just at the Aga Khan Museum actually last week. I was lucky enough to get a tour of the new museum that had just opened. One of the nice benefits of this position.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, very close to this trail too. So I can see, you know, the Brickworks is on the trail, the Aga Khan Museum, and that's quite a beautiful path you could walk between those two unique spaces. So,
you know, I think it saddens me a bit though to think that in the world we live in, so many just people don't allow themselves to engage in design. And when I say design, I should say maybe stretch that and go and say art. You know, I think about how so many people in cities especially, they will, you know, when they get their time off, their big thing is, well, go to the, you know, the coolest, trendiest restaurant, which is cool. Nothing wrong with that. Or, you know, go to the movies, which is great. I love going watching a good flick. But, you know, there's so much great stuff going on in the city. And it's, and I could tell you right now that I could go and speak to many people working in the corporate world who have been living in Toronto for 20 years and have never seen one dance production. Right? Or they don't watch a theater show, or they don't watch a live painting take place, or you name it. All of these phenomenal things that are happening, and yet people will line up to go to the best restaurant, but they won't line up to go and see a great theater show. And how that affects you, right? I mean, people don't realize. I wish they just understood that, you know, you don't have to be a hipster, or you don't have to be, you know, a super cool, jive, trendy, whatever you want to call it, person to be able to appreciate, you know, an off-the-beaten-path theater show. You can go and you can still wear your suit and tie, and that's fantastic. And you'll realize that something in a play might cause you to become a better father, or it might cause you to have a creative idea of a way that you can overcome a particular challenge working in the bank that you work in. It's theater and art in general is not just reserved for fellow theater people.
Right.
Or fellow dancers or whatever. And I think that that's something that saddens me by being someone who is on the pulse of that, and as you are too. I always find myself in these audiences, and sometimes you're one of 20 people and you're thinking, I know there's a lineup right now for the new hip bar. God, I just want to go grab them and say, look, instead of yelling at each other over drinks tonight because the music's so loud, you should come check this out. It'll actually have an impact on your life.
How do you think we get those people from the bar out to, you know, Daniel Spectrum or, you know, Soul Pepper Theater or Fleck Dance Theater, wherever.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that it's, I mean, we're talking about a Goliath beast. I think if anything, it's, well, Malcolm Gladwell wrote about this, didn't he? He talked about, what was it? I think mavens and, connectors and how people influence their own social networks. And I think if anything, you do need those people who are kind of leaders within their own social network, within the corporate market, to be the first ones, the early adopters, or just to adopt it and to be someone who goes out to a show. And hopefully they go back and then they tell somebody else. But I don't know. I mean, when I used to run, I had a musical that I ran for 4 years downtown Toronto. And I had my own little theater, and it was
really
And
what was the musical?
I wrote two musicals. One was called I Decide, and one was called Shift. And I Decide was the first one, and what we did was I had taken over a loft space downtown Toronto, and where I lived, and I built a theater basically in my living room, and it was a huge space, and we would invite people out to come watch it this show once a week, and it was, you know, everyone would always say, anybody who'd ever been to New York and spent time in New York would say, I've never seen New York happen in Toronto until tonight. And really what it was a musical about, you know, the decisions that we make in life and how we those decisions are affecting us and who we become and how we see the world. And the musical would always turn into a party for the audience by the end. And so everyone had a chance to be able to mingle and to meet each other.
Nice.
Yeah, well, it was a phenomenal experience. You would have loved it had we known each other back then. But I can tell you, though, what I noticed is that it would be one of those things where once in a while, well, I shouldn't say once in a while, every week there was always a handful of people who, from, I would call it the corporate arena, people who don't normally engage in these kinds of things, who you would speak to at the end of a show and you'd think that they just had an epiphany. I mean, you could see it in their eyes. They're like, oh my God, this exists. I can access this. And you're like, yeah. And we're just one of hundreds of people in this city that are doing things like this. Mm. I don't know. Maybe it's a cultural thing, or I guess, I don't know. I think it's becoming worse and worse because I think that today we live in a world where people, their clout, if you will, on social media is usually influenced and structured by being at the best restaurant, being at the best bar, and making sure you get your cell phone up and get a picture of yourself in front of the name of the bar so everyone sees that you're at that bar. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there's going to be as much clout if you take a picture with you and your friend, you take a selfie in front of, you know, a theater show that has only 30 people in it. Mm. Which is sad because I genuinely believe, not just because I think it, but because I've seen it, that people will have, it'll have a greater impact on people than it does to go and stand in line and just to get into the who's who bar.
Yeah, I agree. I'm totally, totally behind that. I'm a huge arts patron, but how did you get interested in the arts?
You know, for me, I don't know if there was ever any one thing I could point my finger at, but you know, just even my dad was always a lover of music, mm-hmm. and you would sit literally as a child every single Friday after school, Saturday after coming in from playing, and Sunday after coming in from playing. My parents would have their cocktail hour, as they called it, mm-hmm. and they would be sitting in the living room, and it would start usually around 5 o'clock. Four mm-hmm. or 5 o'clock, they'd have a couple of drinks, and there was always music playing. And if it wasn't music playing, it would be radio shows, that my mm-hmm. Old tapings of theater shows on the radio. And the family would sit around, and we'd get quiet, and we'd listen to them, and we'd laugh, or we'd be exposed to the story, and we would enjoy it. Mm-hmm. Or if it wasn't that, it was the music, and my dad would be breaking down the music, whether it was the Beatles or whether it was jazz or whether it was Elvis Presley, he'd be breaking down why this is good music, mm-hmm. right? And that was, for me, something that was really big in my life, in understanding what makes, I would say, I'm reluctant to use this word, but I'll use it just because it's an easy word to use, what makes certain art better than other art? Mm-hmm. You know, let's face it, to me, I feel as if, you know, a particular song that might be written by, I don't know, U2 mm. is probably going to have a bit more depth to the lyrics than a song that's going to be played by Justin Bieber. And I get that there's a place for Justin Bieber's music, but, you know, I find myself quite often when I'm, especially with girlfriends over the years, or mm-hmm. or friends, we'll be in a car and we're driving somewhere and we're listening to music. And I'll point out, as someone who's written music and written many, many songs, mm. I'll say, do you hear that? And then they'll be like, do I hear what? And I'll say, well, do you hear how during the chorus there's actually four separate harmonies that this mm-hmm. singer is using? Or did you see how they deliberately just dropped the bass line of this particular song just to emphasize that one line and then brought it back in? And I didn't know that my ear had been trained to look for these things because of my upbringing. Mm-hmm. And once you know how to see it, oh my God, a whole other world opens up. You know, music takes on a whole different meaning. It's not just a good song anymore. It's like, I mean, I've always had a hard time getting into abstract painting. Mm-hmm. And, but because
I love abstract.
Right. And then, and there's something you must see that I don't see. And I bet you if I put some effort into it, I could see it. I could learn it. I could understand it.
Possibly.
What do you love about abstract?
Oh, I love it. It can take me just all sorts of places. How do I say it? And it's funny because I haven't been trained, so I couldn't tell you what is sort of like, you know, I couldn't tell you why Jackson Pollock is such a regaled American artist, mm-hmm. you know, from Dropping Paint. Couldn't tell you what it is about it, but I find it interesting and intriguing, and I like it that it's not sort of, you know, rule-based. Yeah, and I can sit and look at like those Rothko paintings, right? Just the big patches of color, and look at the brushstrokes or the lack of brushstrokes, or the, you know, why did he use that particular color or not? It's actually just really how it makes me feel okay. when it comes right down to it.
Do you always feel happy, or does this kind of an abstract painting make you feel sad or feel like a range of emotions? Is it almost always positive?
Oh no! It can be a total range of emotions, right? So. I wouldn't say this abstract painting so much, but I just saw the Bacon Moore exhibit at the AGO. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw that.
No.
Oh, it was fantastic. It was such a good one.
Okay.
And Bacon's work is disturbing.
Yeah. How so?
Oh, it is. See, again, like I remember how I feel, how I felt. I can't remember the details of it, but it's quite, it's along the grotesque, right?
Okay.
I actually couldn't describe a painting to you of his. So okay. This is kind of funny, right? Mm-hmm. So I went through the whole exhibit. I think I went twice, actually. Loved it. Couldn't describe an actual painting to you except for the way that it made me feel, but I found him intriguing.
So what did you feel?
I felt that it was really, actually, for that particular exhibit, what I felt was I felt sympathy or empathy. I felt empathy for how Bacon had lived his life. Okay. And so what AGO did is they actually did a contrast between Moore and Bacon, or sort of compare contrast. And these are two men who grew up in sort of similar eras, you know, both born in England. And to see how their life unfolded, one was sort of a more traditional path and, you know, had won all these large awards and was sort of more accepted in the mainstream view of what an English artist should have been at the time. And one was a bit more radical and grotesque and, you know, had his own personal struggles that he had to deal with. Mm-hmm. But yet they were going through the same periods, the same wars, the same, you know, the same environment. But they came out with completely different work. And Moore's work has always made me feel just a little more calm and soothing. It's, he's got a lot of like smooth lines and it's like, oh, it's quite beautiful. But when I look a little bit more closely, seeing it compared against Bacon's, yeah, it was a little, made me sort of see the suffering, I guess, which sounds kind of cliched, but they were both painting a lot of sort of post-World War II or during World War II, painting a lot of the hardships.
Interesting.
You know, or sculpting a lot of the hardships for painting or, yeah.
It's funny though, when you were talking about how Moore was more accepted because of that particular time and what a, you know, a typical British artist should look like and the kinds of stuff they should create. And it reminded me of, and I'm guessing you've seen the documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop.
Yes.
Right. So Exit Through the Gift Shop, for those, you know, who are listening to this, it's one of those documentaries that really puts into question what is art and and who gets to be the artist, or who gets to be the important artist, and who gets to be the person who's just considered a street artist. And I thought that was such a fascinating portrayal of how people can gravitate towards something and gravitate and make something popular. I mean, we say the Mona Lisa is a masterpiece. Mm-hmm. However, for myself, and I don't want to just assume you have, but I would imagine you probably have. I've walked through, you know, art fairs in the middle of a park, and some 23-year-old who works as a server in a restaurant and does this on the side has painted paintings that I've looked at, and you know, I feel to me is so much better and so much more interesting than something like the Mona Lisa. Mm. I remember, in fact, the one time when I was lucky enough to go and see the Last Supper in Milan. Mm-hmm. And in that room, I'm not sure if you've been there, but there is The Last Supper is painted, of course, on the wall. Mm-hmm. And then on the other side of the room, a lot of people don't know this, there is actually another painting, would be of equal size of The Last Supper. And because, of course, there are so many people who want to see it, there is a real structure to the way you're only allowed to stare at it for 20 minutes. And then the next group comes in and they look at it. So mm-hmm. We're all sitting there, we're looking at The Last Supper, and there's a group of about 15 of us. And yes, it's, I think, kind of interesting, almost from a pop culture perspective, because I've seen this picture pop up in everything from advertisements. Yeah, it's everywhere, right? So I'm like, yeah. Oh, so that's the array. Okay, there it is. Kind of neat. But I started looking over my shoulder at the other painting behind us, and I found myself so intrigued by it. And it was, to me, a masterpiece. And so what was interesting was they turn the group around, the next group comes in, they stand on the side of the room where The Last Supper is, they get to look at it, and while they're doing that, we are now allowed to go to the other side of the room and look at this painting that no one's ever seen anywhere. And we're now looking at it, and you can see quickly the group starts becoming a little less interested. Certain people start checking their phones. Some people started kind of breaking off into conversation. And I was thinking to myself, you know, God, the intricacies of this particular painting, I don't think, you know, you have to be a scholar of art to be able to recognize that it is, I would say, much more detailed than the painting of The Last Supper. And the only reason why the group is dispersing and not as interested because it wasn't made popular by anybody. Mm. And I thought, why is this painting on the other side of the room less interesting when in fact some might be able to argue that it took longer to paint or that it was harder to paint or that it was in the eyes of some professionals maybe better. And it's just because we said that one over there is better. That one over there is more important.
It's amazing what happens when people say, you know, the conversation, like our collective conversation is that piece of art is good. And mm-hmm. yeah. And someone just decided that. Right. So
this is true with restaurants. I find,
yeah,
I see this everywhere in Toronto where I feel like I've been out socially long enough now over the last 20 years in Toronto where I've been able to develop an understanding of what makes a good restaurant good and what makes another restaurant okay. Mm-hmm. And time and time again, I don't know what your experience has been, but I've gone into restaurants that really are, you know, the service is all right. Like they, you know, the kinds of servers that drop the food off and then don't come back to your table until it's time to clear the plates. Mm-hmm. Or you eat the food and it's like, well, it's kind of medium rare. It's close. It's not medium rare, but you know, whatever, it's no big deal. I don't worry about it. But like, my point is that you'll see these places that get these lineups and people say, no, they're like, no. We as collectively have said, this is a great place. But to a real expert, they'd say, no, it's actually not great. You can't just say something's great and that makes it great. That's not good enough. But in art, it is. In the food industry and many things, it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's true. In many industries, that's the way it works. So I don't know. I mean, I think a few things, right? There's just so much going on in the world that people are desperate for direction on, you know, how to sort out.
Yeah.
How to sort out what to pay attention to. But I also think that you missed something, right? Because if you'd spent 20 minutes staring at that other painting, like, you know, what could you have found in that?
Right.
You know, who knows? Or the flip side too is sometimes, you know, the way that I walk through art galleries is, oh, like that, don't like that, like that, don't like that.
Right.
Sometimes I stop at the don't like that's and look at them a little bit longer. But you can't look at everything.
But you get there though. The point is that you at least put yourself into the art gallery. You put yourself in front of the painting, and you give yourself an opportunity to choose what you do and do not like. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the sad thing is that we see so many people who don't allow themselves to go to, you know, a certain place to even put themselves into the position of whether to find out whether they do or do not like something.
Yeah, it's too bad.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny? It's because I've been taking a lot of friends with me to the art gallery now. I've got, you know, these passes. And what I realized is I think sometimes people are intimidated. Like they should know something to be able to go into a gallery. They should know something about art. You know, I've never been trained in art. I've never been trained in art history, you know, I don't even know what you would call it, like critical art thinking, looking at, I don't know what you call it, criticism.
Right. Yeah.
Yes. And a lot of times I don't have the words. Sometimes I feel like I may not even have the right words to express things. You know, I'm a huge, a lover of dance, modern dance.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, never been trained in it, but I know what I like, kind of a little bit like wine, right?
Right.
Just because having gone. Yeah, I went to an art gallery. I think it was like it was really a date. It was just kind of with a friend, but you know, I think he'd felt the need to actually go and do a bunch of research, which I think is a great thing. But I can tell when we were looking at the pieces, there was I don't know if it's intimidation, but he felt the need to seem like he could sound knowledgeable, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot of people, we do that a lot, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes what I love is that I love going through art galleries behind kids.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're just like, that's weird. That's, why is that guy got a chair up his nose or whatever, like the thing is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll just ask the questions that we all want to ask. But
yeah.
It's just in such an unfiltered way, right?
I always love it, you know, and not to bring it back to the restaurants, but I always think it's so funny when you're sitting around with a bunch of friends and the food, you're in a perhaps like a, you know, a finer dining restaurant, and when the server brings the food, they're saying, okay, well, what we have here is we have a lamb reduction stew, and they go, there's a jus from a particular berry that we put, and everyone's nodding. I was like, oh, right, yeah, mm-hmm, yeah, got that. And I'm always like, I have no idea what you just said. I'm thinking this, and the reality is probably most of us have no idea what the guy just said, and we're all just so desperate to look smart and be like, yeah. It's like when someone, you know, whenever I order a wine in a restaurant, I always have the same thing. I say, look, because I hate paying a lot for wine.
Yeah.
So I'll say, give me a bottle of wine. I said, what's a bottle of wine that you like that's full bodied that is between, I'll say, whatever, $30 and $50?
Mm-hmm.
And, or I'll say close to $40 if you can do it. And they'll say, oh, okay. And then that's the easiest way of doing it, because it's like, If you're going to have a conversation with me about the thickness of the grape's skin during that particular harvest and this particular region of California, I'm like, dude, I don't know what you're talking about. All right? This is a silly conversation, and I'm not going to be one of those people who pretends that I know what you're talking about. And this is actually an interesting thing that I've done in my own life, which is I've always been in the kind of person that says to him, I've always been a big believer, just go to the experts, right?
Yeah.
So if it is, you know, if it is choosing a wine at the liquor store, I go to the main guy, and I'll say, here's my price point, here are the countries I like, here are the kinds of tastes that I like, and take me to it. And they get to it, and they'll start explaining why this is good. I'm like, nope, I trust you. You don't need to explain it. I trust you.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is, and I think that people should consider doing that with other aspects of their lives. Like, don't just go to a restaurant because it's trendy. Ask people who are in the know, and they're going to point you to a place that doesn't have lineups and that is probably more reasonably priced, and you're going to have dinner there, and it's going to be one of the best damn dinners you ever had in your life. And do the same thing with theater. Do the same thing with film. Do the same thing with every category in your life. Ask the experts, people who focus a lot of attention on it and who think mm-hmm. about it all the time, and because of it have become experts. Why waste time? I've always said the same thing. It was like, I never understood why if I go into a Shopper's Drug Mart and I need to pick 6 items up, I don't need to become an expert on the blueprint of Shopper's Drug Mart. There's already somebody in there who has it. So I just find them, and I'm like, okay, I break it up.
I'm so going into your local Shopper's Drug Mart to find that guy.
Oh yeah,
the guy that helps.
Oh yeah, they're the
helps
best.
You walk every time you walk in.
Every time.
Where's the aspirin?
Yeah.
Where's the...
Like, unless you like it, people for sure who do like wandering, that's fine, do it. But if you don't, then just go up and say, I got 3 items. Here are the first 3. Okay, thanks. Where are you going to be in 2 minutes? Over there? Okay, I'll come back and find you for the next 3 because I can't remember all 6. And then I'm in and out. Boom, boom. 3 minutes. Kaboom. There you go, everybody.
Efficient. Nice.
Yeah. But I think that there's something exciting in life about going to people who, you know, who know the blueprint of a particular thing, and to say, hey, look, teach me, what do I need to know? And then it really does allow you to cut through the noise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So hopefully, well, you know what, that might be a good place for us to end the conversation up. We've almost gone an hour, and it's one of those ones where it's like, I always like to end things off in that one kind of piece of advice or that one little nugget that everyone can walk away with. And if anyone is listening to this, I'm hoping, you know, if you heard me say that, you are listening to this. For those who are listening, you know, try it once. Pick a category, pick something you haven't done, go out there. You know, if you don't go to theater, choose theater. If you don't go to dance, find somebody that you know who knows them and say, hey, recommend a great show in the city at this price point. Try it out. And if you like it, then just do it again.
Sounds great.
Good advice.
Yeah. Excellent.
Brilliant. So, well, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. It's been a great conversation. It's been our first time that we've actually had a long one-on-one like this. So
It is.
Yeah, I like learning about you today.
Yeah, me too, Stuart.
Yeah. So, okay, stay in the line there. But for those of you in listening, thanks for tuning in. And we will see you for the next podcast. But this has been Heather Tay with me, Stuart Knight, on The Stuart Knight Show. Speak to you soon.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you've enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.